Our New Testament lesson today comes from the second chapter of the Gospel of John, verses 1 through 11, which may be found on page 87 of your New Testament. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The word of the Lord. Question: how much water does it take to wash away sins? Answer: it takes a river. At least that's how much it takes in India, according to an Associated Press news release. Listen to how the article begins. Allahabad, India. Millions of Hindus plunged into the icy Ganges River, hoping to wash away their sins at the opening of a festival that falls every 12 years. "I've come here to get a new life, to wash away the sins I have committed in the past few years," says Pratap Gar, a teacher who is wearing only a loincloth in 38 degrees temperatures. As many as 65 million people were dipped into the river's waters for a holy bath during the last 43-day celebration. In India, it takes a river for 65 million people. In Israel, in Jesus' day, it took considerably less. The ritual of purification was strictly regulated within the Torah. The Torah declared that one needed to get clean by ritual cleansing in order to get close to God in worship. It specifies that about a cup of water was all that was necessary to purify over 100 men. One cup of water per 100. Now, I want you to hold on to that thought as I segue to our text and then come back to it. When we think of the story of Jesus at the wedding in Cana, our first and sometimes only thought is miracle. And that's true, as you heard in the children's message this morning. This story is about a miracle, a time when Jesus defies the natural order of the universe, transcends natural science, and turns water into wine. This morning, I want to expand your thinking just a few steps further down the line. What Jesus did was more than a miracle. It was a sign. That's what John calls it. He calls it a sign. A miracle is simply the reversal of the natural process. In the Gospel of John, Jesus performs signs. A sign is something that points beyond itself to something else. It transcends the meaning of what is visible, and it anticipates the future. For instance, if you were to see a red and blue flashing light in your rearview mirror, you don't matter-of-factly think, oh, there is a policeman behind me. No, you check your speedometer. You slow down from 80 miles per hour to whatever the speed limit is. You prepare to stop, and you anticipate something that is coming in the future. Turning water into wine is more than a story about a miracle. It's a sign that is laden with meaning. It anticipates and says something about what is going to come in the future. Today, we read about the first of a series of signs in John's Gospel. Listen again to how this story unfolds. And I'm amazed that Jesus' mother is so succinct in it. Well, Jesus is at a wedding in Cana of Galilee when they run out of this wine. Poor planning on someone's part. Jesus' mother urges or tells him to do something about it, possibly run to the nearest vineyard and grab a few more bottles. But no, he pulls a fast one on them. He turns the water into wine. The servants take the wine to the wine steward of the feast for approval. Now here's where I have to confess that I know next to nothing about wine. I am not a winosaur or a connoisseur of wine. I could not tell a 1954 Dom Perignon from a 2015 Gallo. However, doing my due diligence, I did learn a bit in preparation for today's sermon from the website entitled Veni Vidi Vino, which means I came, I saw, I had some wine. And I highly recommend the site to you if you want to learn the etiquette of wine tasting and how to tell if a bottle of wine is fruity, nutty, corky, or austere, short, and foxy. Nevertheless, the steward of the wedding, no doubt, sniffed the cork, poured a little in a cup, gave it that swirl, checked for the bouquet and the clarity, tasted it, and said, "Now that's a nice barrel of wine." Or words to that effect. Actually, his words were more like, "Most people serve the vintage wine first, and then when people have had a lot to drink and are not able to notice the difference, they serve the jug. But you've kept the really good stuff for the end." Now, what keeps this little vignette, or vino yet, from simply, sorry, couldn't help that one, from simply being a miracle, is not the transformation of water into wine, but the nature of the water itself. And we don't usually think about this much. Jesus doesn't run to the local community well and haul up a few buckets of water. No, he takes the water that was meant for the purification ritual at the wedding. And this is more than just a couple of bottles. It is the equivalent, three jugs is the equivalent to 120 to 180 gallons. Oh, happy days. But this bit is excessive in anyone's book. Anyone's book except for God's book. You may recall in the Bible, anytime God does something to provide for God's people, God does it in excess. God gives way too much. When the Jews were coming out of captivity in Egypt and wandering hungry in the wilderness, the book of Numbers reports that God sent a huge number of quail, up to 100 bushels of quail for each person. In Matthew, when Jesus takes 5 loaves and 2 fish and feeds well over 5,000 people, he has 12 bushels of food left over. There are two accounts of excess fishing in the Gospels. In both incidents, the disciples are skunked. They fished with no luck, So Jesus tells them to try again. In one case, they brought up so many fish that the boat began to sink. In the other, the net was so heavy that they couldn't lift it into the boat, so they had to drag it ashore. So with that in the background, what are we to make of this story about excess wine? Well, I think that there are at least two points that our gospel writer is trying to make by including this story as the first act of Jesus' ministry. The first point that John makes is strictly in the details. John tells us something that we're likely to miss if we simply focus on the miraculous water to wine transformation. The detail is that this is the water that was used for the rite and rites of purification. Part of its being a sign, the thing that points down the road to the future, is the fact that Jesus overturns a system that has purification at its center. The elaborate system had been developed over centuries of time, which named some things pure and other things impure. Women, for instance, were impure for 7 days after the birth of a son and 14 days after the birth of a daughter. Dead bodies were impure. People with blemishes caused by leprosy or other diseases were impure. Certain foods were unclean, and almost anything sexual was impure. And the list went on and on and on. New Testament scholar Marcus Borg, in his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, talks about Jesus' confrontation with this vast purity system. He says, the effects of the purity system was to create a world with sharp social boundaries between pure and impure, righteous and sinner, whole and not whole, male and female, rich and poor, Jew and Gentile. You see, changing the water into wine was not primarily a way to spice up a party. It was an act of transformation, a breaking down of boundaries, social, political, religious, a different way of seeing the world and God's presence in it. God was no respecter of human boundaries, prejudices, and preferences, as specified by the rites of purity, or any other rites for that matter. Jesus was here for everyone. This is a sign that points beyond the miracle. The second point made by our gospel writer had to do with excess and quantity. Remember the cup of water that it took to purify 100 men? That's what the Torah requires. 120 to 180 gallons was figuratively enough holy water to purify the whole world. The reporting of the outsized acts of God, of the excessive generosity of wine or quail or fish, is not just primitive exaggeration. It is a graphic way of saying something about God which is beyond measure. Beyond measure. A few years back, there was a celebration for the blessing of animals, and it was held in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. It's an annual occurrence, the usual participants being a few dogs and cats, parakeets and gerbils, ferrets with turtles, pets that are fit for life in the Big Apple. But according to Bishop Paul Moore, this particular year that he refers to, things were a bit different. A circus must have been in the area because into the cathedral walked an elephant. Yes, there was an elephant in the room. The bishop did not flinch or miss a beat. If Jesus could provide 180 gallons of wine for a wedding, and God could send hundreds of bushels of quail for each person in the wilderness, surely God could bless an elephant in a cathedral. The whole world is in God's hands, and God's hands are surely big enough for elephants. That's the point. God's grace, God's generosity, God's mercy through Jesus Christ is to be unlimited, more than enough water for purification, more than enough wine for the wedding, more than enough love, overflowing and extravagant. You might say that this first miracle, this first sign in the Gospel of John, contains within it the very heart of the gospel. God's love through Christ is for the world. It knows no bounds. It knows no limits. His purification, his justification is for all. And there is more than enough grace to go around. Now, this wonderful news, I think, poses a slight problem for you and for me, and one that I know that we can overcome if we stay focused on God's love. You see, we are now God's representatives here on earth. It is up to us to show to the world, to a world in need, God's abundant, magnanimous grace. That is your charge, and that is my charge. God's love is overflowing. Let us go forth and share that love with the world. Amen.